The remainder of the time is for discussion, or if you have questions.
I have a question. At lunchtime today, you said something about every morning you think one day closer to death, or something like that. Could you please say a little more? Because you added, it's not an unhappy thought. I thought, ooh.
Well, I think death is the end of one's life, and I think that's something, an event of great importance to look forward to. So, not something to dread. So that's what I meant. But when you see it on a personal level, you know, people are afraid of death because they take it like, you know, I'm going to die and that's the end. And then we don't, you know, when we, you know, the Buddha's pointing to the deathless, not to, you know, some kind of, you know, that it's not meant to be like annihilation of anything, but a fulfillment. So for a Buddhist, like death is, if you've practiced and developed, then death is a kind of ending of this condition. So it's can be seen as a joyful thing rather than, you know, rather than seeing it as the end of me. And especially, you know, as you get old, old age has its own problems. It's now much harder to get off the floor. Than it used to be. I look at these young people kind of jumping up. And I think, oh, I wish I could do that. No, I think, you know, like deathless is reality. And that by like recognizing that the deathless is awareness itself. So if you recognize and cultivate from the awareness, then there's nothing to fear, because death is only frightening or unpleasant or dark if you see it as the end of me. But you know, when you see the end of yourself going on constantly, you know, like the ego, and you know, how you rebirth, how you seek rebirth all the time, and looking for something fulfilling and getting what I want or getting rid of what I don't like, and then one is always seeking rebirth, but never recognizing the death that happens regularly. So, like, death is a heavy word. So the end, and say, beginning and ending, and birth and death, they're the same thing, but just different. You know, birth and death usually is around the physical body, but mental states are coming and going all the time. So then the gate to the deathless is awareness. Recognizing that, then cultivating that, you know, being this deathless awareness itself. It's not a personal identity. I can't claim it. You know, that's why I can't say I have realized the deathless or anything like that. It doesn't make sense. But, because then it sounds like I some kind of personal statement about me as a person. But when you recognize reality, it's not like some personal achievement. Personal achievement only comes out of attachment to yourself, yourself as a personality, as a physical body, or a intellect or emotional conditions. I have, this one doesn't, it just vibrates. He just gave me some cheese from Cheddar. He said, "We have something for you that does not beep, bleep, or vibrate. It just sits there." Yes? Oh, you get, like when people steal something, one feels very angry or threatened, because one's so attached to, you know, like, this is mine and you shouldn't, it's not yours, and you're what you, even if they steal something that isn't particularly valuable or anything, but because of you still have the sense of ownership. But also, I mean, people do that, you know, we've had thieves here, and you do, you know, how you feel is like this. But, you know, I'm more interested in looking at the feeling rather than, you know, pursuing it or trying to. And whenever the monastery gets burgled, then we get into, we've got to build alarm system. We all get into trying to protect the place even more. And, you know, even, you know, we do feel, we've got to, you know, lock the gates, put on burglar alarms, get a few Rottweilers. But also, it's, you know, in the end of the day, it's more useful to observe that than to just spend your life trying to protect everything, you know, and endlessly, you know, build a fortress around yourself. Because even then, they find some way to get in. It just seems to be the way this realm works. You know, like I was in Egypt last December, and we went to the, you know, the pyramids in Cairo, Giza, and so then we, you know, and they burgled, hundreds of years ago, they burgled the pyramids, and yet they were supposed to be burglar-proof. Well, they're so well made, they're very impressive. But the burglars did find how to get inside them. And then they stopped building pyramids and they built these huge tombs in the Valley of the Kings, Valley of the Queens, in Luxor. So we went there, and there they have, you know, built into the hillside, you know, these huge caverns where they would put the bodies of the pharaohs and the treasures. And most of them were burgled. And yet they were, like the pyramids definitely stand out. They're like a deliberate invitation. See, you know, can you steal from me? You know, they're so obvious. But these, the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, Valley of the Queens, they just kind of blend into the mountains, you know. You don't, they're trying to make them, they don't want them to stand out and show anything. And still the burglars would find them. And then they recently found one that burglars never never burgled, never found, but they, you know, they eventually, archaeologists have found it, and they opened it up. We went in it, and you know, it was really stunning because it was quite deep in the hill, and then they had they had these chambers, gorgeous chambers for these mummies and artwork, you know, the Egyptian art, you know, like 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, in colors, you know, they used bright colors, and they're still clear and bright, you know, like, and quite beautiful, quite elegant. But, you know, the Egyptians were obsessed with death, and building, so much effort went into tomb building and in trying to understand death and life and death. So they you see so their temples, their tombs, their pyramids, so much energy from a whole kind of civilization built around death. So it's obviously, you know, something that we're, I mean, quite naturally, you know, bewildered by, the inevitability of death and what comes after. Because when you think, you can't imagine, you know, you can't imagine some kind of other realm you go to. You know, like if you've been good, you can imagine some kind of heavenly realm. Or if you've been bad, you can imagine a hell realm. Or a limbo realm, kind of where you have to wait for the day when you'll be saved or something. You can imagine anything on that level that is conditioned from the best to the worst. But the deathless, you can't imagine. Now, this is quite significant. You know, that's why the word deathless or the unconditioned, these are so bewildering to us. It's like death is the end of everything we know on the conditioned plane. You know, so try to imagine what happens when you die. You know, and then, you know, when this body dies, what will happen? And I can't really do it. I just don't know. You know, I hear what other people tell me, or possibilities. I can imagine any kind of other realm that you go to, like some kind of heaven or hell realm or what. But the deathless, the unconditioned, this is beyond imagination. Well, that's because it's here and now. You know, it's not something you imagine, something you recognize. And this is, so when you, that's why in the Buddha's teaching, the awareness, appamado amattapadang, the paying attention to the here and now is the deathless itself. So it's real. It's not just some abstract metaphysical concept like it sounds. So that's where the Buddha's emphasis on awakening to reality, you know, to the real, rather than just living in this realm of illusion or delusion that we tend to believe in. So, and yet it's so simple, and yet it's so, you know, when you try to figure it out, you can't. It sounds, to most people, Theravada Buddhism sounds like annihilationism. You know, they can't, it sounds like what we're doing is just trying to reach oblivion, and, you know, kind of destroy, you know, end up in a kind of void of nothingness. It's what it sounds like logically, taken from a Western perspective. But the Buddha made it very clear that isn't what he was saying. That's the way it sounds on the thinking level. And that's why I encourage you to really investigate thinking. Not from thinking about thinking, but from observing the thinking process. So I've, you know, spent years observing my thinking process. whatever it is, good or bad, silly, stupid, intelligent, profound, shallow, nonsense, whatever. Just to see, you know, to get to know that that which is aware of thinking is awareness itself. It's not a thought. It's real. Awareness is, I don't create it. It's not made by me as some kind of special state. It's recognized and it's realized. It's reality itself. And therefore, once that really sinks in, that is enlightenment. You know, you've seen from the deathless, and then the death-bound conditions are seen from there rather than according to, you know, your own views and preferences and fears and desires. So the fear of death falls away. Because, you know, there's just the bodies die, thoughts cease, emotions arise and cease. What you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, this comes and goes and changes. But this awareness is a constant. You know, it doesn't cease or get born. It's just you're beginning to recognize it. This is reality. This is true. This is a fact. And then your relationship to the conditioned realm is discerning it and knowing it. And then how we live then in the world is through doing good, refrain from doing bad. You know, so how I live in this society is to do good, to keep the laws, to obey the laws, to try to live as a good citizen, to be honest and cooperate and helpful in the society, just like a good citizen would be. You know, not to cause more strife and dissension and hatred and endless demands and criticisms and blame, that one might have if you're operating from your own personal, habits. Like I'm educated to be critical. So it's easy to live here and be critical of everything. You know, so, you know, just see, you know, a critical mind always makes a big deal about anything that isn't quite right. So you see, oh, I don't particularly like that. It shouldn't be like this. Then you, but if you recognize that there's enough critics in this society, you know, my criticisms aren't, you know, if there's anything urgent, I'm quite willing to let, you know, if I think it's going to benefit. But if it's just my grumbling mind or my arrogance, you know, it's best not to say it. And then my relationship to the society is trying to support what's good in it and to try to help it, try to support what's good in this society. So then you're fulfilling your duties as a good citizen. This is a worldly condition, but this is where this practice allows you to you're not just thinking of yourself and thinking, I just want to leave the world and I don't care what happens to this country. You can go to the dogs for all I care. I'm just going to get out of this. You know, it's not like that. Your relationship to the world is one of compassion and love rather than of endlessly complaining about it or abusing it or taking advantage of it or just ignoring it. Yes?
You go through all these different bardos and and they seem to relate to something that happens while the other, one is alive as well, going through being confronted with sort of one's own mind and
Well, I read it years ago, before I'd ever meditated, Tibetan Book of the Dead. But what I kind of gleaned from it, I haven't read it since, so I can't, and I don't. So this is just say something that reflection from that the first thing, you know, when somebody dies is they see this bright light. If I remember, and that usually they're not prepared for that, so they turn away from that, and then they on the wandering on the bardo is to find a place where they can recognize, to seek rebirth. You know, so you go through this 49-day journey, but
and all these fearful
days. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how that relates, that they seem to know that.
Well, that's where the bright light, you know, like if awareness is that. Like that's why when you're developing sati sampajanya or awareness, intuitive awareness, then this is where you're living in the light. And so I mean, this is my interpretation, but from that point, then the rest are more like the things that manifest, you know, while you're still alive. Things will still manifest, like fear, repressed fears, and unresolved things in your emotional habits will come into consciousness, but from this enlightened position, then your relationship to them is just letting them cease. You know, you're not reacting, you're not resisting or grasping anything. So in meditation, they aim to, you know, like in mindfulness meditation, things will come up in your consciousness. You know, so for example, the one I tell about the first few months when I ordained as a samanera in Thailand, you know, I'd repressed anger for, you know, I was 32 years old, repressed anger. So then the first few months I just felt angry all the time. And it wasn't due to anything, nobody's making me angry, I couldn't blame it on the monastery or anything, but it was just this repressed anger coming up. And then I began to just sit with, allow it to manifest, and then it would, and after a while, just by accepting it, it all kind of dissolved, went away, without repressing it. And so this is from, you know, from an experiment in this life with, say, with anger and fear. So, and then what I remember the Tibetan Book of the Dead was this bright light. Usually we're not prepared for it. It frightens. I mean, especially, you know, it depends on how good you've been in your life too, you know, but if you've been been a gangster or murderer or something, imagine it's just too unbearable, you know. So you run from it, seek a realm that you feel kind of at ease in, or that you feel an affinity with. So people do seek affinities with. Oftentimes, you know, where they don't have to face it, maybe the demons or the wrathful deities or whatever that arise. Where if you're in Buddhist terminology, you know, you know, one of the taking refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha is a way of, you know, it's a skillful means to establish that sense of awareness as your refuge, and in which you can then deal with with the demons that arise. Like say the demons that I experienced were like anger. I didn't refer to them as demons because I don't think in anthropomorphic terms very much. You know, it's just not my way of thinking. But it's more psychological, like anger was not due to any immediate causes. But everything, you know, the resentments from the past, you know, it's from childhood even, all kinds of bitterness, resentments, anger, and that started arising in consciousness. Well, they're like demons, you know. If you want to give them an anthropomorphic, iconic form, they could be said to be demonic, some of them. But because of the commitment to the samanera life, monastic life, you know, and then so I didn't, you know, I didn't speak. I mean, I was in a place where nobody could speak English too, so that was another thing. I had nobody to go and complain to. I had to figure it out on my own, and so that was and I couldn't speak their language then either, so I just had to bear with it. But then it's through this awareness that these repressed things that are latent, or what they call anusaya, or latent tendencies, and that will arise into consciousness. And then your relationship to them is to be observing, be the knower of them rather than the owner of them. So some of them are, you know, demonic, or you know, some were just plain stupid, you know, just kind of dull, dreary things, and you know, jealousy and fears and all these kind of emotions. So then the attitude of awareness of them means that you let them come and let them go. And then more and more, when you do that, then you're actually purifying the, you know, the consciousness is then, you're not repressing or controlling it anymore out of fear and ignorance. You're actually allowing pure consciousness to function, rather than just you being conscious through fear, through desires, through ignorance. So like people, we're all conscious, you know, the consciousness is the same, but then, you know, we can live in our own world of fear and greed and anger and see everything, interpret everything through those perceptions. And then when you let them go, then your pure awareness is deathless. It's intelligent. It's not like it's full. It's complete. Not like you're kind of living in a void of nothingness. But it's not what you can't think of it. You can't create it. You have to recognize it, realize it. Yes. Well, it's not like you know. So many things are just what you know. It's your intention, you know. If making a fortune is just for out of the ego to compete with others, or I mean, you know, if one can maybe. You know, there can be other more altruistic ways, making a fortune to help others, or things like that. But it's more or less, you can decide how you want, what you want to do, you know, what your intention is. But if they make a fortune just to, you know, to be better than somebody else or have better material things. I mean, I certainly understand that. And it, you can't say it's good or bad in kind of black and white terms. But we can also, you know, determine our own intention towards what we're doing. So, you know, like it's, you know, to the intention can come from a kind of intellectual choice. And then from that we can be aware of our own maybe emotional involvement with what we're doing. It's like in monastic life, intention, say being a monk, is to realize the truth and to be free from selfishness. Then in the monastic life you go through all kinds of deluded states and selfish habits. But that's not my intention. You know, I didn't intend to live this life in order to increase selfishness and delusion. But as I, you know, the intention was to be free from it. But in this life also, you know, these kind of emotions will operate. And then I keep affirming it's not my intention for living this life. So when that selfish reactions arise or whatever, then I can accept them, you know, see them in terms of they are conditions changing, let them go. And so that I can, it's like keeping going in the right direction, like guiding star, you know, that he keeps you going in the right direction. Because in the nitty-gritty of everyday life, you've got to deal with, you can't keep looking up at the star, you've got to deal with the different conditions, you know, that are right here and now, you know, walking and breathing and eating and so forth. So, but if you don't have any guiding star either, you can easily get distracted. So, you know, one loses one's way, you know, if you don't know which way you're going. So, you know, like to me in the ordination ceremony, I say to realize the truth and be free from delusion. And I remember when I said that, I think, oh, I don't know if I can do that. You know, I saw myself in critical terms. You know, so you know, I felt it as an altruistic kind of wish. But as I developed more understanding of how to use the conventional form that I've taken on, then I began to see it. I keep reminding that my intention, no matter how involved I get, you know, like, you know, as you become a senior and you, you know, people, you get a lot of praise and people know you and your ego can get quite inflated as a Buddhist monk. So if you're, you know, you start getting titles. I've been given very kind of posh titles, monastic titles, things like this. So if you there's a certain kind of pleasure in being appreciated and receiving accolades from the royalty and all that, but. Also, you know, you realize I didn't ordain for that. That's not why I'm a monk. And that's not what I, you know, not like seeking that. That's not what I'm really interested in. But if you keep that direction, then you keep going in the right direction. But if you don't know it, you can get overwhelmed with thinking yourself is a very better monk than the rest or whatever, somebody important. I mean, even in monastic life, it's still you give up everything, then everybody wants to give you everything. It's ironic. Yes? Well, the genders aren't equal. So, you know, they're different. But in terms of moral precepts, then we have to figure out what do we agree on in the moral commitment, and the goal is the same. So because this is like enlightenment is not a matter of gender. So it's not the prerogative of any gender, but then in terms of karma, and then we have to deal with the male female conditions that we encounter, and also tradition. We're in a tradition that was established 2,550 years ago. So, and that was based on the conventions, but more moral conventions and social conventions. So in terms of the because the West is very much interested in the ideal of equality as a kind of ideal that should be applied, but the realities of a given situation are, you know, the conditioned phenomena is just not equal. It's you know, it's just different, infinitely different. Two men, two women aren't the same, and so our relationship to the difference is one of knowing it and observing it rather than identifying with it. So then the relationships in this tradition are established through the convention, which is kind of moral agreements as established in this convention. This is a very touchy issue at this time. Because, I mean, but it is interesting to, you know, to recognize, because, like, the idealism, everybody's equal, I consider that an ideal. And, but an ideal is not real, it's not reality. It's like, because I can create ideals in my mind, perfect ideals, you know, everything is exactly as I think it should be, you know, and where everything's fair, just, equal, perfect, and that's an ideal that if I operate, if I grasp that ideal, then the realities of my life, I just complain. Even about myself, if I idealize what a Buddhist monk should be as an ideal, then I'm just incredibly self-critical, even after 40 years. Because, you know, the ideal is based on these perfect states of, you know, like they're like marble images, or they are beautiful, but they are ideal. Ideals don't feel anything. You know, they're intellectual. They're not made of nerves and blood so that you can create ideals. But this is where recognizing what being human is like this. So, you know, we can idealize the perfect human female body or male body, you know, as an ideal of what it should be. And it's never old or fat or it is beautiful, but most of us have to live with bodies like this, you know, that are that are not what the anywhere near to the ideal. So then we become critical of our bodies. You know, so we feel we're never good enough or beautiful enough or whatever. You know, you can see in the modern society the idealizing of the female. You know, what a glamour and beauty is in the female makes is so, you know, intimidating to girls now. That, you know, they have all these anorexic problems and things about trying to make yourself into this, fit this ideal. And so you know, you don't understand the nature of your body or how to live with it or appreciate it. You just see it, measure, contrast what you think you see in a mirror with some ideal of a perfect female form. And you're always going to be critical. Because it's just the way the mind is, the way it is, you know. So this is where, you know, the mindfulness is not critical. And it isn't sloppy either. It's not saying anything goes, it doesn't matter. But it is aware, and that awareness recognizes the human condition, which is like this. It's not an ideal, but it is... you know, we have to live with forms like this that are so subject to many other conditions of change, and that beyond some we can control, some we have no control over. And so we begin to recognize this state of being human, not through idealizing, but through recognizing it. So then, in terms of relating to the world, to others, men to women to men, is one of a moral agreement, not to exploit or take advantage, lie, steal, sexually abuse each other in any way. So these are our way of agreeing how to live with each other. So this is what we can actually agree to. And then on the ultimate level of enlightenment, of seeing the Dhamma, realizing Dhamma, then this is where it is equal. Or it's beyond equality, because it's not an ideal, it's real. The deathless. Yes?
What is your view in regards to the monks protesting in
Myanmar? I haven't really thought about it. I mean, it's very confusing because there's so many things wrong with that country, you know, that you can't blame them. But... you know, I can't really comment on it. But, I mean, like in Thailand, for example, you hear terrible stories about, you know, these refugees on the Thai-Burmese borders, and they're murdering the Karens and burning their villages, and all kinds of horror stories. And yet, when you go, I went to Rangoon, a couple of years ago, and Bagan, and you know, it's a gorgeous country, and Srettagon is one of the most beautiful Buddhist holy sites I've ever seen. And you go there, and there's so much, you know, you can if you just stay in those places, you can think, oh, this is a very nice country. Everything's all right here. And then, you know, the first thing they did when we arrived at Srettagon was one of these generals wants to give me a set of robes. And then you're always suspicious, you know. Like, generals been out killing all these people, and then they want to make merit by giving me a set of robes. That's how my suspicious mind works. But, you know, banadibata, not in killing other humans, is, for a Buddhist country, it seems to have been shoved under the carpet. Same in Sri Lanka. You know, that these are power struggles. And this is what I mean when I'm saying how power blinds you. You know, you do anything to keep it, murder anyone or deceive or, well, you know, if you're blinded by that, by having power, political power or influence on others. And that's why it is a dangerous, this Asura realm is very dangerous. Because it is, you know, you can even fool yourself by thinking that I'm killing all these people in order to help the country. Get rid of these nasty people that are always causing trouble, just murder them and get them out of the way. And there's a kind of logic to that. But in terms of moral precepts, it's evil, you know, it's wrong. You can never justify murder or intentional killing. And so you can make a case for it in terms of a logical thing, you know, if you know, like killing criminals or capital punishment. You know, I understand the reason why they want it. And there's even a part of me that emotionally kind of agrees, you know, some really horrible, horrible criminal has done atrocious acts. You know, part of me also feels that they should be killed. It's not that I'm beyond that, but I don't agree to that as a way I would not put that into action or speech. Because, you know, the one thing I find is that people do change, and you know, there have been so many cases of criminals or people, murderers or whatever, have been imprisoned and then change, become very good people, and we're still hung or electrocuted. You know, they keep them in these death row for years and then kill them. Where, you know, you realize people can change and they've got to always give that opportunity and option to them. Because especially like some, there was a case in California. San Quentin Prison across the bay from San Francisco, where this Thai man was blamed for the murder, robbing a store or something, and the owners or something were killed in the process. And he was arrested, and he said he never did it, but there was evidence or something that they felt was good enough. And so they imprisoned him. He was in San Quentin Prison for 20 years or more, completely changed, became a very good prisoner, taught meditation, Buddhist meditation in the prison, was an exemplary inmate, both to the prisoners and to the guards, was greatly loved by everybody. Ajahn Pasano, the head monk at the Mayagiri Monastery, our branch in California, was with him when he died. And Ajahn Pasano, I mean, he begins to cry every time he thinks of it. This man was so, become incredibly kind of skillful, helpful, compassionate person. And yet they electrocuted him, or whatever they do there, injection. And because of the politics. At that time, everybody, even the governor of the prison, wanted to recommend amnesty, but the new governor of California wanted to prove that he was not soft on crime. So they executed him. It was a really sad story, but from what Ajahn Pasno said, the man was not bitter about it. You know, so I mean, at least he didn't die in a bad, mentally bad place. But yet, you can, if we get punished, look at what happens with reward and punishment. Like, this is how the society works. You know, you're rewarded for being good, obeying the rules, and you're punished for being bad, not obeying the rules. You're rewarded for being a good student in school, and you're punished for not being a good student. And you're praised if you bring the teacher a gift, and you're ignored if you don't, or whatever. There's all kinds of, you know, signs in the society of, you know, you know, as a child, you learn how to survive in the society, because, you know, you figure it out at an early age, how to get through, how to live with your parents, how to get through this educational system, because it's all about reward and punishment. And this is what we know. This is oftentimes, you know, I can see myself doing this in the monastic life, rewarding the good monks, the good nuns, and punishing the naughty ones. No, it is. It's based on this dualism of right, wrong, good, and bad, and so that's where we absolutize right and wrong. Something's got absolutely right or absolutely wrong. And the word absolutely is now just a common word in English language. You say, well, absolutely, it's absolutely true. Do you believe in it? Absolutely. You hear it all the time. And so it's like words, concepts seem to have a kind of absoluteness to them. But this is where this reflection on impermanence is so encouraged in meditation, because conditions are not absolute, they change. You know, something that's absolute is fixed, it doesn't change. But if it changes, so right, you know, something that's right is not absolutely right. It's right at this moment. And then, you know, it might not be right the next moment, you know, but this is where your intuition needs to, you have to have that intuitive sense to recognize this. Or that people, crime should be punished is right, you know, as an idea. But then in terms of the realities, you've got there's other factors than just this kind of truism. What do you mean by punished, and what do you take into the consideration the conditions that are never the same? You know, no two criminals, even if they rob the same bank, they have different karmic tendencies, different attitudes, different all kinds of differences. So when you try to absolutize things, you get stuck in this rigidity where you go by the book or by this reward and punishment belief, which tends to stop compassion. So your compassion you can ignore to be right. So, you know, like getting rid of Saddam Hussein. You know, he was somebody nobody liked. And, you know, the whole you know, the whole year, not even the Iraqis and the Muslims. And I mean, he was a perfect villain for us because he was so, so bad. And nobody was really ready to stick up for him and say, you know, it's wrong to kill this villain. It's morally wrong. It seemed right. You know, he deserved to die. In fact, I think he got off too easily. They should have dragged him through the streets. And you want to, you know, he should really pay for his evil ways by a slow, painful, tortured death. And then, you know, revenge mind. But these are not conditions that I would, I want to cultivate in myself. Revenge and righteousness, feeling so right that I lack any appreciation or sensitivity towards the realities of a situation. Because if I, you know, if I feel I'm absolutely right, then I can't hear anything else. I become very righteous, and that I can be quite cruel when I get into being very righteous. So this is where this awakened state is encouraged, because then we, you know, we're not operating from this dualistic habit anymore, but from the Dhamma, from wisdom, from truth, rather than from cultural attitudes or logical prejudices or biases or you know, just righteous feelings or fears that we have about the world. And then, you know, and the more that we awaken in this way, that'll affect everything, you know, the environment, the population, the people around us. You know, it's often wondered why it's not worse than it is. There's so many people on this planet now, and they all seem so terribly ignorant. That why isn't it worse than it is? And you think, well, because basically we're very good. You know, we love the good. It's our nature. We want to be good. We love the good. It's not that I'm not, I have to be good because if I'm bad, I'm going to be punished. I'm not good because I'm afraid of being bad. I'm good because I like that. I respect that. And that's something that benefits me and benefits the society I'm in. It's not that I'm good because I'm repressing my dark side, because if I release that suppression, I'll just be blown away, becoming some kind of totally dissolute kind of murderer, whatever. You know, I don't incline towards finding joy in murdering or stealing or lying.